chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you say it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are. Rest make heaven in the middle of it. Rest make heaven in the middle. We are rest make heaven.
Secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. We've gotten a lot going on this week. We've had this cruiser out of the Black Sea that was sunk by two Neptune missiles fired by the Ukrainian shore battery. It was lured into the area about 65 miles off the coast of Odessa there. And I think there were three Turkish-made drones operated by the Ukrainians that possibly kept the ship busy on its anti-missiles, you could say, and operated in such a way to distract them from the incoming Neptunes. That's the way the story goes. It sank. All hands were lost except for maybe 15 survivors. So that is really a major loss. Coming up, starting our first hour here is Greg Reese, and he's always got some interesting points. Here we go. And then we're going to get into this idea about this snake venom that was put forward by Dr. Artish, and Mike Adams had some really insightful interviews with him, and we're going to clear up some misunderstandings that occurred on that snake venom. But anyway, to start with Greg Reese, here we go right now.
Social media from the CCP rarely ever makes its way into American pop culture. But in early 2020, they went viral with radical videos of forced quarantines and sealing people into their own dwellings with welding torches. Were Americans shown all this to make our own lockdowns seem less devastating? And if so, what are we to make of the new social media blitz coming out of Shanghai? People are being starved in their own homes. Their pets are being killed. And it's getting so hellish that suicide is seemingly an everyday part of life now in Shanghai. Just because things are feeling a bit more liberating in America doesn't mean the lockdowns are over. How in the hell are these Democrats going to win an election without another lockdown? They are already setting up the narrative and have invested in new mobile testing machines. If you think Trump is somehow going to save you, even though he helped in the last lockdown and proudly gave birth to the deadly vaccines, he just sided with Dr. Oz.
The way I endorsed another person today, Dr. Oz in Pennsylvania. Dr. Oz. Great guy, a good man. He's a good man, Harvard educated.
And Dr. Oz loves the CCP lockdown model.
And the Chinese numbers have dropped dramatically, which is fantastic news. And it's also valuable for us to understand why they were able to do that. If you look inside of Wuhan province, they had a catastrophe. But outside the province, which of course they quarantined in the largest movement of its nature ever, 60 million people blocked in that space. But the rest of the country was relatively spare. They didn't have the big spikes, the huge crises that Wuhan experienced, and it took the country to in a very different direction. We just have to copy what they did, take their blueprint and repeat it here in this country, and we started that aggressively over the last week.
In trauma-based mind control, the abuser alternates between abuse and comfort, which forms a bond with the victim, known in pop culture as Stockholm Syndrome. This might not work on you, but they are not doing it for you. They want the majority on their side when they start arresting people like you for forced vaccination and, of course, gun confiscation.
Well, China has a number of problems, two of which are that their complete lockdown, which was their approach, a strictest lockdown that you'd never be able to implement in the United States, although that prevents the spread of infection, and remember early on, they were saying, and I think accurately, that they were doing better than almost anybody else. But lockdown has its consequences. You use lockdowns to get people vaccinated.
Reporting for InfoWars, this is Greg Reese.
Coming up next is Dr. Ortiz interviewing, was interviewed by Mike Adams. And this is an extended interview. I wanted to put up enough of it so that the listener would understand it. We're going to put up the full interviews also and share those on my site. So you'll be able to go in and listen to the very, very total interview and to get sort of flesh it out. But here we go with Dr. Ortiz interviewed by Mike Adams.
All right. Welcome, everybody, to this Breakdown Conversation special report with Dr. Brian Ortiz, whose bombshell allegations and documentaries just came out a couple of days ago. And, you know, a lot of people are very concerned about snake venom origins or venom-related peptide origins for COVID vaccines, or is it in the water supply in certain areas, or is it in the treatments that are being given to people? So since that has broken, some questions have been raised, and we decided to bring Dr. Ortiz back to join us and help answer some of those questions. Dr. Ortiz, it's great to have you back. Thank you for your courage for speaking out. Thank you for joining us today.
Mike, it's great to see you. It's been an overwhelming and emotional journey for the last 4 months. And since this news all broke last night, it is no different.
Well, give us an overview of sort of what has the reaction been. What have people been texting you or calling you and saying? What's the reaction?
So I have to say the overwhelming reaction, which I was very concerned, I was just overwhelmed that any of this information I was led down a path to discover, as I feel, has been led and inspired by God to uncover this stuff to help warn and inspire and protect as many innocent people as possible. I'm still worried that the information was going to be so monstrous that many people would deflect immediately and not trust the information or not want to even consider looking at it. So the overall response has been way more supportive than I ever imagined. And I'm not kidding. 90% of everything I've heard has been nothing like, oh my God, this makes sense. And I want to actually throw something out to you. I woke up this morning, and this is a couple things that, Mike, you know, when I brought this to you, I was hoping that any gaps that are filled in this, like, story could be filled in by other people who are experts in their field. I'm not an expert in all fields. I'm not even an expert in water supply, so I just want to get this water supply out of the way. The one thing that's been the biggest negative has been lots of people talking about there's no way this is in the water. How can you even say they're poisoning the water with snake venom, blah, blah, blah. I want you to understand something. Water has not been my story. This is not even the biggest part of the story. I have said from the beginning for the last 2 years, whatever the bioweapon is, even when I thought it was just a virus engineered in a lab, I actually said, whatever their weapon is, it's not very good because less than 1% of the entire world has died from it. Whatever they've been investing billions of dollars into, 99.997% of everyone worldwide has survived. That means God's creation's been way greater than whatever man's weaponized, whatever it is, was. So even with the water source, if that is the source, I never thought it was dangerous. I never thought it was horrific and demonizing, and everyone needs to go look at the water. So I want to make sure the water thing is handled here, and then I'm going to tell you what really was cool to me for an example that's happened last night and has continued throughout today.
Okay, well, hold on a second. Hold on. Let me, about the water thing, you know, I found it a little bit surprising that some people were giving you some pushback on the water issue. It's as if they've forgotten the decades of water fluoridation. The water supply has been meticulously, systematically poisoned with toxic fluoride, which is a neurotoxic chemical, and that's dripped into the water supply, and usually it comes in the form of a powder originally, and then it's put into solution. Well, in every municipal water center, there is a machine that drips the quote, proper dose of poison into the water supply, folks. So how can anybody say they're not poisoning us in the water? And then secondly, what about Flint, Michigan? What about all the lead poisoning in the water supply, that huge explosive news stories? What about all the poisoning from, you know, DuPont chemicals in the water supply? I mean, come on, people. To say that you can't be poisoned in the water supply, I mean, it's just ignorant. It's absurd.
I actually believe it's ignorant also. In fact, the people who have reached out and given me pushback, my immediate thought, Mike, has always been, every time, they've been using fluoride in your water at some level that they believe it has a biological reaction in the people who are drinking it.
That's correct.
They're putting something in your water, and then to actually kind of diffuse everyone's attention on water if you don't like the water concept. When people keep asking me, what proof do you have it's in the water? How about you just look at what the CDC's been doing, what they've been actually testing the whole time looking for the bioweapon called SARS-CoV-2. They have 400 water testing sites in different cities around the country, and they're sticking cotton swabs, doing PCR testing on your water looking for the weapon. It's called SARS-CoV-2. They're looking for this virus, they call it virus, in your water. And even you, before we started pre-recording this, she said, yeah, but they're going to say wastewater. I said, well, they're going to filter that wastewater, and then it's going to become what? It's going to become your source water. And this has been what I've said on multiple platforms already today, Mike, and I'll say it here. I can't see anything yet where the CDC has proven to me that they're not only testing the water for SARS-CoV-2, this really deadly pathogen, and then at the same time, they are filtering it out of your water before they give it back to you. I've never seen that. I've never seen or read anything about that. All I keep reading is, we are testing all these sites looking for the bioweapon called SARS-CoV-2 in the water, and they have been using this one sole source as the predictor for outbreaks in your city. Only in the water. They're only looking in the water. So I just want you to know, if the CDC is looking in your water for SARS-CoV-2, maybe we should find out, are they actually filtering it out as they find it? And if they are, this is brilliant. They're trying to protect us. That's great. But that's not what they're saying. They're saying they're using this as a predictor of future outbreaks for your town. What? It must be recirculating into the town. You're going to be breathing in it.
You bring up a really important question in all of this. So as you said, what they're testing is wastewater, which is, you know, post-sewage. I mean, it's sewage water. But, as you also say, the sewage water gets treated and turned back into drinking water. And this is true all across the country. I mean, a lot of people maybe don't think about it this way, but what comes out of your tap was coming out of someone's toilet upstream, up the river.
Exactly right.
Right? So the question then becomes the treatments that are taking place in these water districts. Do these treatments remove SARS-CoV-2? Do they remove potentially snake venom? Do they remove, you know, what do they remove or what do they not remove? And I don't yet know a comprehensive answer to that question.
I don't either. So the fact that governments around the world, this has been very enlightening, Mike, people around the world keep writing in and publishing articles and sharing them with me and other groups that I'm a part of, that all of a sudden they're realizing every single government in their countries has been doing wastewater surveillance testing for SARS-CoV-2, and they didn't know it the whole time.
Wow.
Oh, my God. Have they been poisoning the water right under our noses, and we never knew it? How did Dr. Artis come to this? The truth is, Mike, and I really want to convey this, the story for me is not the water. My whole agenda has been for 2 years to save people's lives from hospital protocols. It just turns into that I got a text from Dr. Richard Bartlett. I'm going to tell the whole world who it is because he told me last night I could tell you. He's the one that sent me the text that said, Dr. Artis, if you got bit by a rattlesnake, would you go get antivenom? On December 1st, 2021. Ever since then, the entire scope of COVID-19 and the reality of what it really is has completely transformed, regardless of the source of how they're distributing it. It is enough evidence to now go start looking to see, is it true that the bioweapon itself, either through gain of function or they've just been dumping synthetic peptides of venoms in the water or aerosolizing them, however they're distributing them, is it true that it is snake venom peptides or animal venom peptides? And if so, go look. Test the people who are, they actually have already said, like we showed on your show, the University of Arizona said, those individuals treated for COVID-19, they described that the tissue samples and the blood samples, the amount of this enzyme called SPLA2, it looked like venom coursing through their veins because this enzyme is found in rattlesnake venom. You need to start looking at, is it possible there are components found in venom that is orchestrating this whole plan? Because when you start to look at the mRNA shot side effects, they almost all of them can be tied to a specific snake venom component. You can also look at SARS-CoV-2, the infection and its side effects, like loss of taste and smell. These are actually side effects of snake venoms. They are, and it's not customarily a side effect of viruses, and it's been very mysterious. Well,
yeah, and
let's go look.
So I'm glad you mentioned multiple vectors about exposure. So Dr. Lee Merritt, for example, believes that probably this has been distributed in cities as a contact poison, which is another way because, you know, skin-penetrating nanoparticles, that was part of the EcoHealth Alliance proposal to DARPA for release in China in the bat caves. You mentioned water as a possible vector, and you also just mentioned an aerosolized release as a possible vector. And I think what you're trying to say to people is, hey, don't get stuck on the water. There are multiple vectors. The point is, maybe it's in the air, maybe it's on contact surfaces, maybe it's in the water, but people are being deliberately exposed to these nanoparticles that you're saying were derived from the structure of venom peptides, because those molecules are extremely toxic and are generating the side effects that you're seeing. Is that a fair summary of what you're saying?
That is a great summary. In fact, I want to say something to Dr. Lee Merritt. She texted me this morning, and she's like, Dr. Artis, you're going to have to show me evidence about this water sourcing with snake venom. And I said, Dr. Merritt, you're missing the point. I need everybody to go look at the weapon. I don't care where it is. I said, and then I told her, I said, look, Dr. Merritt, they're finding it in the water. Our government agencies are spending millions of dollars finding it in water. It's obviously in the water also, whether through shedding of feces or they're poisoning you like fluoride. Just know the weapon is venom. Treat it like an envenomation, and you'll solve the riddle of the mystery of SARS-CoV-2 infections, the side effects of the vaccines, and the hospital protocols being used for COVID-19 infection.
Okay, yeah.
It's really common. They all find these snake venom-like properties in the side effects and in the enzymes in their bodies.
Yeah, that's what's fascinating. That's a lot of the response that I've received also from the first part of our interview was that it was shocking how closely the symptoms match up. And also, you provided a tremendous amount of documentation. So, you know, there's been a lot of due diligence happening today. Scientific American absolutely did publish the story. I think it was in 2020 that's mentioned in your presentation that talks about that SARS-CoV-2 has the most similarity with snakes because of the codons and the genetic similarity. That's absolutely true. And CNN covered it and other science journals and so on. So people who say, well, there's no research to back this up, I don't know what they're watching. Or they're not watching it because it's all, we put it all on screen, actually.
Mike, one of my favorite things to do when we did your interview that I really just, it kind of solidified it all for me, was that British Medical Journal, I don't know if your audience has seen it yet, but when the British Medical Journal Global News published last year that right now there are two health crises going on at the same time around the world, they said, snake bites and COVID-19. Two crises going on at the same time around the world, but they have one research and development in common. There's only one research and development opportunity to handle both. Do you want to know why? They didn't say that there's two things going on at the same time. They did not say that there's bat bites and COVID-19 are two crises going on at the same time. Nope, they're very specific. Snake bites and COVID-19. And the codon usage bias, as we showed you from those studies in January of 2020, the codon usage bias, that is a specific term that specifies the genetic origin. Well, this study found the codon usage bias for SARS-CoV-2 was most identical to the common crate or Chinese crate snake and the king cobra. And we even went over the squared Euclidean distance with you. I was shocked you even knew what it meant. But the most similarity was genetically sourced was two snakes, not bats, snakes. And still, a year and a half later, you're seeing other journals publish that snake bites and COVID have a lot in common. Not bat bites, COVID and snake bites. Yeah, they have a lot in common. They both have snake venom in them. That's what it is.
Yeah, and it's, you know, what's really fascinating about this is how much research you brought to the table. And I turned that over to my editorial team also to go through a lot of those articles and citations, and it really is shocking. So one of the reactions happening today from the left-wing media is like, oh, this is crazy, snake venom, crazy conspiracy, where do these people get this stuff, right? You know, attacking you and Stu Peters and so on. But then it's all in the research. It's all in the articles. It's like, but the funny thing is by attacking you over this, they are forcing people to think about snake venom for the first time.
So, well, and the British Medical Journal saying that snake bites are a crisis on the world right now. Maybe you should all be looking at venom.
Yeah, well, I mean, people are for sure right now. Let me ask you a different question about remdesivir, because one of the things that we did today as journalists is we sent an email to Gilead Sciences and requested an interview with their chief science officer to respond to some of the information that you presented. So, you know, I want to be on the record that, hey, we're giving Gilead a chance to respond to this, and I have a lot of questions for Gilead, too. If they agree to an interview with me, it'll be a fair interview, but I got a lot of questions about why are people dying from, you know, after taking remdesivir and so on. But I want to give them a chance to respond, and if that happens, Dr. Artis, I would give you a chance to respond to whatever they say as well. But, you know, isn't that, I mean, I don't think they're going to say yes to that, but if they do, I would welcome it. What do you think?
You know, I've had a medical doctor here that Dr. Peter McCullough referred me to that thought they could help me get remdesivir to get it tested in a lab. Multiple labs.
Yes.
They put in multiple phone calls, emails into Gilead Sciences, medical doctor did, to request remdesivir. I even offered to pay full retail price for it. And they never responded. Not once did they respond over several months. And that's fine. They don't have to respond, but I want to get it tested. The fact that, for example, what really tied this together for me was when I read the University of Arizona study when they were evaluating blood samples of people treated for COVID-19 in two different hospitals, hundreds of blood samples. These people all received remdesivir. That is the only antiviral being used for COVID-19 patients. Every single one of them, they said, had high elevations of this phospholipase A2 that is found in rattlesnake venom or viper snake venoms. And then I was like, oh no, well, is there a connection to Gilead and this Indian king cobra venom that was our study that was published in January of 2020? Genentech funded the study. Genentech actually has been acquired by Gilead Sciences. Just 10 years earlier, they bought up several facilities and brought on 55 of their executives. And I would like to know, do they have cobra venom or snake venom in their product? Has University of Arizona found these snake venom enzymes in COVID-19 treated patients in hospitals? It would be interesting to find out.
Well, yeah, it is interesting, but just for the record, I mean, those enzymes could also come from other sources, or there could be synthetic peptides that were based on the research of snake venom, right? Several different scenarios, but I want to add too, you know, our laboratory, we have a time of flight mass spec instrument, and if Gilead responds to us, I will offer to them to send us a sample. We'd like to test it on our time of flight instrument. We are an ISO accredited laboratory, you know, audited, inspected, we pass tests, you know, blind tests and so on. And the thing about the time of flight system is that it has an amino acid or a protein deconvolution algorithm that can handle the very large molecules, which is what snake venom typically is, you know, very, very large. But that instrument can handle up to 20,000 Daltons. And so, you know, it'll be interesting. would Gilead Sciences send a sample to a laboratory run by the health ranger? If they would, I would do it honestly. You know, I'm not going to fabricate anything out of the lab. No way. We're going to do it honestly and report what's in there. But we would then be able to see actually the molecular mass of what's in there. Wouldn't that be fascinating?
That would be fascinating. I hope Gilead answers the request in a positive manner and provides the sample. I will also say that, yes, it is absolutely true. Venom peptides from snakes, snails, can be and has been synthetically created in mass quantities since 1989. So these peptides, these weapons, could be made synthetically in factories, and they're dumping it anywhere. I mean, it could be, or it could be used in general.
It could be.
Genentech, for example, the company that Gilead acquired some of these facilities from, Genentech created and funded a study isolating all of the 19 venom-specific toxins in king cobra venom, published in January of 2020. Genentech declared a conflict of interest with a company called Roche that they own stock in. Genentech, who also had facilities bought by Gilead and acquired from Gilead, who makes remdesivir, Genentech right now has multiple patented drugs that are cancer therapy drugs, each of which are actually derived from snake venom components. That's what Genentech does. You can go look it up. You don't have to fact check it, just go look it up. So the question is there a correlation to the side effects of remdesivir, which perfectly overlap remdesivir's description of its side effects from the published studies by Gilead and the World Health Organization database review over the last 2 years? I would like to know, are they using this because they're finding these snake venom-like peptide enzymes in people who were treated for COVID-19?
And also, yeah, you know, a really good point. And also, the history of medicine is a history of biomimicry. And, you know, over the years, we've seen many, many articles in science.
Everyone needs to break this down because it's not an easy subject. And these spike proteins and all these other peptides and so forth can be rather confusing. But coming up next is Dr. Artis interviewing Dr. Richard Bartlett from Odessa. And Bartlett has a lot of things to say, especially injects Mengele into the conversation. That is very interesting. So here we go with Dr. Richard Bartlett, interviewed by Dr. Artis.
Welcome back to the Dr. Artis Show. This is a special presentation we're going to give Dr. Richard Bartlett out of Odessa, current licensed practicing ER doc in Odessa, who's been blowing the world apart with information that he's had spiritually given to him, I believe, based on his clinical experience. He was able to reach out to him and let him know that budesonide in a nebulizer would be an effective treatment to stopping SARS-CoV-2 lung infection to help people improve and recover.
You know what COVID does? It causes the release of cytokines, those poisons from the lung lining. Did you know budesonide shuts off the release of those right at the source?
Is this something they're doing in hospitals since the moment you actually recognized this and started letting everybody know, like Ted Cruz, Donald Trump?
It's happening when patients' families stand up for their loved ones in the hospital, and they demand budesonide nebulizer treatments for their loved ones. We have Senator Kratz, a retired senator in Georgia, who demanded this for his wife, and his precious wife got off the ventilator out of the ICU to you this week. We have a judge from Fort Worth whose father has emphysema, was in the hospital on a ventilator for a prolonged period of time, has emphysema. The doctor said he's probably not going to do well. He's probably not going to get off the ventilator. He would not take no for an answer when he demanded nebulized budesonide for his father. The doctor said no, no, no. And he had some friends that were also judges and attorneys, and they all pushed in unison. And guess what? They said, okay, then he's off the ventilator. He's out of the ICU because this makes sense. It's not something that is not my message. This is the truth. So Oxford University confirmed it with the Stoic trial, the principal trial, two randomized controlled trials, saying 90% of hospitalizations for COVID could be prevented with one medicine, inhaled budesonide against COVID.
Now, how long have you been saying
this? How long have you known this?
A year and a half. And so I've been saying this for a long time. Fauci saw a video that I did that went viral, 5 million views in 2 weeks. And so he got Matthew McConaughey to do an interview on the internet. And McConaughey said, what about budesonide? People say that works. And Fauci said, well, in reality, Matthew, it's just a placebo. That's not what Oxford University says. And he didn't have any, Fauci did not have any randomized controlled trial to back it up. He doesn't offer science usually when he says something.
No, they don't.
No. You know, I think there was a fellow named, on a separate topic, there was a fellow named Joseph Mengele who was speaking for, he was the medical voice for a government, and whatever he said went, and you don't speak against that. But you know what? If they don't offer science, they have nothing to refute what we're saying, and they knowingly are blocking it, trying to put obstacles to people getting life-saving medicine, they will be held accountable. And there is a God who will also judge you. But we're in the United States, and it is not over yet, Anthony Fauci.
How long have you been practicing medicine?
30 years, and I actually treat patients. I don't know the last time he treated a sniffle. I actually work as an emergency room doctor. I'm actually part of the Texas Division of Emergency Management, a state project right now to give monoclonal antibody infusions to our people in Texas. I personally am on the site 11-hour days, 6 days a week, surrounded by, immersed in infectious COVID patients on purpose, because in monoclonal antibody infusions decrease your chance of dying or being in the hospital by 70%. But budesonide prevents it by 90%. So we are not helpless. We're not hopeless. There are effective early outpatient treatments at work. And the science is settled. If you go to budesonideworks.com, hours of useful information, links to studies. But the truth is, people can be treated with early COVID with budesonide or with monoclonal antibody infusions. But they can also be treated with late disease, which is acute respiratory distress syndrome, in the hospital with nebulized budesonide. The studies are already there. This is not a new novel idea. It's inexpensive. It's readily available. And therein lies the problem. It's inexpensive. Nobody's going to get rich off of this. You know, remdesivir is $3,100 and a guaranteed 5-day hospital stay that the hospital is going to bill for.
Do you know the CMS.gov?
And did you?
Puts out a 20% payout for codes using remdesivir for all CMS patients, Medicare and Medicaid services.
Well, did you know that I used to be on the hospital board of a private hospital, and we would celebrate if we negotiated a 20% payment for appropriate medical care from Blue Cross. And so 20% was our, we thought that was amazing. But guess what? You're saying they're getting an extra 20%.
20 bonus on top of it, and they have the codes on the form. Put this in for remdesivir treatment.
Does this
pay out 20% more for Medicare patients?
Does, you know, things are starting to look pretty obvious at this point. You know, we
don't have a bribe.
Hey,
do you think our federal government should be bribing doctors and hospitals to use and incentivize remdesivir treatment?
I'm going to say, doctor, that when you have effective, readily available medicines at every pharmacy on every corner that could prevent 90% of hospitalizations, we shouldn't have the hospitals overwhelmed. The CDC should be giving emergency use authorization or just authorizing it as a treatment. Not because I say so, but because Oxford University, the oldest university in the English-speaking world since 1096, with 72 Nobel Prize laureates, says so, in two randomized controlled trials, that's called science. The science is settled. The Stoic trial, the Principal trial, but also in the hospital, there's studies that are vetted by the NIH at the NIH database that say that nebulized budesonide for patients on the ventilator in the ICU with ARDS benefit in four ways from using nebulized budesonide. It shuts off the release of the cytokines, the poisons at the source. They drew the blood and proved it. It improves their blood oxygenation. Hey, that's a good idea for COVID patients that are in the hospital for oxygen. And it also stops the scarring in the lungs and the remodeling. That's important. And it also stops the swelling, the edema in the lung tissue. Those are four good things. For every pulmonologist that comes across this video, shame on you if you are withholding life-saving treatment for your patients. Shame on you if your patients die without you giving a trial of nebulized budesonide 1 milligram nebulizer treatments for your patients, especially if they're on the ventilator. That's a closed system. It can't spread through the ICU. Stop saying busting myths like that. If you're one of those myths, I'm a myth buster. Stop lying. If someone's on the ventilator, that's a closed system, you can't spread it. If someone's in the hospital and they're not on a ventilator, thank God, you can move them to a negative pressure isolation room. That's what they're for. If someone comes in your hospital with Ebola, you move them in the negative pressure isolation room. You idiot. You can do that for budesonide. Give them nebulizer treatment. Save their life. Give them a fighting chance.
Shame on you. I would like to reiterate. And I want to ask, Anthony Fauci and the NIH have been putting out the protocols.
Next up is Jay Dyer telling us a lot about ghosts in the machine. The ghosts are the spiritual part, and the machine is our body, our natural body. And this Kessler out of England has a lot of really diabolical things, in my opinion, to say in this book. But Jay Dyer lays it on the line. Here we go with Jay Dyer.
Welcome back to the Alex Jones Show. Today I'm going to be covering a text that is overlooked. It's one of the more important global elite texts. It's one of those inner core texts that was circulated amongst the Royal Society, amongst the scientific literary elite of the British Empire. And that's the book Ghost in the Machine by Arthur Koestler. I read and lectured through this book many years ago, and I couldn't believe what I actually found in this book. It's pretty well known, again, as I said, amongst those academic and scholarly and Royal Society elite, but I would say outside of the circle of those academic scholarly circles, it's not very well known. But this book has had clearly a very important impact, and we're going to notice the continuity once again of the agenda going all the way back to the Malthusians, to the Darwins, to the Daltons, to the Wedgwoods, the Huxleys. We're going to see that consistent pattern working all the way up through the very important writings of Arthur Koestler in his 1967 book, The Ghost in the Machine. He begins by saying that we all know now that evolution is a dogma. Evolution is something that can't be questioned. And he says, what I'm going to do in this book is I'm going to take the insights of evolutionary philosophy and psychology, and I'm going to combine it with J.B. Watson's behaviorism and materialism. He says, we know that in principle, there is no soul, there is no psyche that we can identify under a microscope. But he says there are things that could potentially point to higher level realities. So he's not completely a behaviorist materialist. In fact, he says that no, there's actually a deeper force at work behind nature that isn't strictly speaking physical. He does mention that the Rockefellers and the Skinner, B.F. Skinner operant conditioning was very important to discoveries made in the behaviorist disciplines. But he says that we can't reduce everything to the physical. And so he says that I ended up working closely with Harvard and Yale individuals, this sort of CIA Eastern Coast Seaboard elite nexus. And he says, and together we were able to work towards solving human psychology and human modus operandi. This was all part of the conquering of the inner domain of man after they believed they had conquered the exterior domain. So now the mind is the last sort of frontier to be conquered. He goes on to say that using rat studies, for example, I got this old book out, so like all the dust is in my face now, but you may have heard of the recent rat studies called the Beautiful Ones, right, where people looked at how society would reorganize around pampered and sort of exalted e-celebrity rats and how they would become the sort of the Instagram rat stars of their rat maze. He talks about the same type of stuff back in the 60s, and he says that rat studies showed us how to analyze and control human societies. And he says that there's a problem in rank materialism, that rank materialism doesn't satisfy, you know, people's inner desires. It leaves people sort of empty and nihilistic. It doesn't answer a lot of the questions about the forces in nature that go beyond just merely the physical. So he says that we got to come up with some other kind of philosophy or worldview to explain beyond the material. Now, he is not in any sense a theist or a Christian, so don't misunderstand me. In fact, he says that the immanent force within nature is what a lot of religions and people have called God, but it's not some sort of personal God. It's just a kind of pantheistic nature and process. So according to Kessler, it's not God or any kind of theism or deity. It's just the natural universe itself, and process is God. And that is pantheism in terms of theology. So it's a return in a way to ancient pagan philosophies. And you could see analogs to this in today's society with people like Richard Dawkins, right? Richard Dawkins says, I'm not a theist. He says, and I don't know if there's a God, but if there is, it would be something like aliens and or pantheism. The universe is God. What's the problem with the idea of saying the universe is God? Well, as Kessler moves through this book, he goes on to talk about nature itself, again, having organizing principles. Now, you're going to see a really nefarious bait and switch that Kessler will do with the notion of reality or the external world or nature being a self-organizing principle. Again, it's not a God who organizes nature within divine providence or that there's some purpose in it. It's a reality that's an impersonal force, something like the force of Star Wars, right? That organizes itself on its own. So it would be like chaos somehow giving chaos intention, meaning, and purpose, or telos in philosophy. So in other words, I'm just pointing out that doesn't actually make sense, but watch what he will do when he applies his notion of holistic organisms in nature to understanding individuals, because you can start to see that this is going to be an attack on a certain type of view of man and individuals to argue that you are against nature if you don't join the collective. That's the route you're going to see with where he takes this. By the way, that's the exact same thing that Salk does in his books. Right, Salk says that Jonas Salk says that we have been under this mistaken idea since the Enlightenment that there are individuals. There are no individuals. You are just merely one organism in the collective. You are one molecule right now in this gigantic thing that works together as a whole. And apart from the whole, you don't have any meaning or existence. And in fact, you are a cancer on the collective. And just like Salk, he's going to argue that we're going to have to get away from this idea. He says we're going to have to get away from the idea that there are individuals, and we're going to have to introduce to everybody that they must be part of the collective. Now, his one of his compatriots, Aldous Huxley, wrote a book called The Perennial Philosophy, where he argued that there will be a religion in the future, and it will have a reaching for, a grasping for something beyond the material. So they never intended, I don't think, amongst these people to leave everyone in a rank materialist view of the world, right? That all that exists is matter, right? I'm not talking about going shopping and buying a bunch of Gucci bags. That's not what I mean by materialism. I'm talking about the philosophical view that all that exists is physical, solid matter, right? That's what materialism is. And that's the view that comes out of a lot of the atheist Enlightenment philosophers, really comes to the forefront in Victorian England. And a lot of the Royal Society people that really promote the worldview of scientism, Bertrand Russell, for example, right, in the same circles as Kessler, they also promote this idea of rank materialism. And you can see that at the same time of the 60s, 70s, right around the time, interesting, of the counterculture revolution that these people fostered. And get this, Kessler himself, back in 1960, before any of the, you know, Haight-Ashbury, Laurel Canyon people in the so-called counterculture had been doing this, he was doing hallucinogens, psilocybin, and so forth with Timothy Leary and with other people at Harvard. So he was tripping balls at the same time as Leary was before everybody else. And what he started to realize was that there's more to reality than just the physical. And this is a pretty common phenomenon amongst people who take hallucinogens and have had trips. I've done that in the past as well, in my younger days. And it does tend to sort of give people the potentiality for breaking out of the worldview of rank materialism. I'm not advocating that. I'm not saying people should do that. I'm saying that that does happen at times when people take these substances. And I don't know for a fact if that happened with Kessler, but after 1960, when he had these LSD experiences or these psilocybin experiences, he did go on to later write this book and say, hey, there does appear to be a life force and an immanent power beyond the material that is moving and sort of causing the flow of the universe, of the natural world. And it does seem to direct things towards some purpose or individual purposes based on those systems within nature. So he says, let's call these systems in nature holons. And for him, that is little organisms that work together for a common goal. Now, I'm not necessarily disagreeing with this idea. I think clearly you can see, you know, plants and trees and different things in nature, various bugs, organisms. They do operate in this way, right? Ants and ant colonies, right? They all work together as a common purpose within the ant colony. Bees do this, right? The queen bee. And so this is well known. I'm not taking issue with that. But watch what he's going to do to adopt that and say, you see, nature tells us that we cannot be individuals. We must only be collectivists. We must all submit to the collective. And that is precisely what Huxley said in his perennial philosophy. He said the religion of the future will be basically you must be absorbed into the universal blob. Have you seen The Blob? The old 50s one and the 80s one, which is fun as well. Let's get into The Blob when we get back. Don't go anywhere. This is the Alex Jones Show. I'm your guest host, Jay Dyer of jaysanalysis.com. Welcome back to the Alex Jones. I'm your guest host, Jay Dyer, Jay's Analysis. We were looking at the important, influential text by Arthur Koestler, The Ghost and the Machine, and you can begin to see what he's talking about there with the machine referring to nature or the human body itself, and then the ghost being the soul, the mind, the spirit, the life force, whatever might be on the physical machinery of the meat sack of the body. And in 1967, Koestler had as I said, had been working on this, published this, and then he also, at the same time, had written about his experiences with the drug culture, with psilocybin, and referred in cases to Huxley's Doors of Perception. So we know that, again, even amongst the Royal Society-type elites, there was this familiarity very early on, very far ahead of the 60s counterculture revolution with hallucinogens and with, you know, breaking on through to the other side, as Jim Morrison talked about. And many of these guys had done that, right? They had had these experiences and then applied them back then to their worldview. And I'm making that point because over and over and over, we see that this very important connection between the hardcore hallucinogens and the attitudes and views of the people in these circles, especially the MKUltra doctors who helped, of course, promote and create LSD, and the big pharma corporations that helped them synthesize it and put it out on a mass scale. And what you can see is that these people, including Bertrand Russell, I don't know that Bertrand Russell was doing LSD, but he did talk about free love, right? So back decades before the 60s countercultural revolution, people in the Royal Society, like Koestler, like Huxley, had talked about the potential effect of releasing these things in the public and the social reorientation and reengineering that these things could have. And I say that just to point out that they were aware of what they were doing. This wasn't an accidental thing. They knew that it would have these effects, and they at least wanted to study them in regard to what elements they didn't know. What would this actually do to society when we let these things loose? And they had seen in their own lives, right, the effects of how hallucinogens had changed their attitude towards reality, how Huxley, you know, wrote about this in various texts that he did. And it's odd, too, because at times many of these people, whether it's John C. Lilly or whether it's Huxley, they would at times talk about it like it's demonic, that when they would have these experiences, they even seem to be aware that the entities and things that they would interact with were in many cases demonic. They were intensely evil beings of hatred that wanted to destroy and deceive humanity, and they always have the same message. Now, I'm not saying everybody has a bad trip, but in fact, in Koestler's case, he actually did have a bad trip. But I'm not saying everybody has a bad trip. I understand that. But the message, curiously, is always the same. Why is that? Why don't we get some clockwork elves or DMT beings that, I don't know, tell you to be nice and humble and to marry and have a bunch of kids? The clockwork elves never say that, ever, right? What do they say?
Ooh, we love you. We want to kill you. The only way to save your planet is if everybody creates a world government and kills everybody. Then we'll love you and you'll be safe. Well,
that's what they always say. They'll watch on YouTube countless people's DMT trip reports. They all say the same. Why? Why would they all report the same thing?
the DMT elves told me we need to work together, create a world religion and a world government, and if we kill everybody, then the aliens will let us live.
That's always what they say. And it's no different than what they told these people back at this time. And they even said, well, yeah, I'm interacting with entities, and they seem to be demonic, but I guess we better do what they say, right? Especially in the case of John C. Lilly, right? He explicitly even says, sometimes when I would have these deep trips, I felt like I was interacting with Lucifer or, extremely demonic beings, but hey, I guess that's what we need to do. That's the power in the universe. They're the immanent force within the universe. And I have to mention, because I just finished these two books, if you don't know, C.S. Lewis, who, famous Christian apologist and writer, I'm sure everybody's heard of the Narnia series. A lot of people don't know he has a separate series that was less famous called the Space Trilogy. And in the Space Trilogy, he wrote, again, very prophetic, way ahead of its time, about the alien deception, right? So in that a Christian dystopia, and to my knowledge, that's the only Christian dystopia that I'm even aware of, he talks about how there would be this kind of alien deception. He even calls out the global depopulation eugenics agenda, especially in part three, where you have what's basically, for all intents and purposes, the Illuminati. He doesn't call it that. It's called some acronym. It's called, like, NICE, N-I-C-E. but it's supposed to be the scientific humanitarian organization that has a front of helping the world, but secretly in the inner core, they have made a deal with the demonic off-world entities, a.k.a. demons, they're calling aliens, to radically depopulate the planet. So C.S. Lewis predicted everything that we're seeing nowadays long ago. Now, how and why did he do that? Well, he was in the circles of people at Oxford and Cambridge, like Bertrand Russell, like the Kesslers, like the people in the Royal Society that I'm talking about, Charles Galton Darwin, these people. So he knew what they were up to. And he probably didn't feel like he could just outright write about it because people would say he's crazy or whatever. So he put it into fiction. And this is a classic method that we've seen many British fiction writers do.
We're going to finish up this first hour with about 5-6 minutes of news, a summation of the news by a BBC reporter. It's good to have some reporting from offshore, just to get a little bit different perspective. Here we go with the BBC's summation of the news.
Russia has formally warned the United States and its allies against supplying further weapons to Ukraine. The Kremlin said that the arms shipments could lead to what it called unpredictable consequences. Speaking during an interview, President Zelensky has acknowledged that up to 3,000 Ukrainian soldiers have died and as many as 10,000 have been left injured since Russia invaded his country in February. Meanwhile, there have been reports of new strikes on the outskirts of the Ukrainian capital, Kyiv, and also explosions have been heard in the western city of Lviv. And in the last hour, the Russian Foreign Ministry has said that it's banning the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, as well as other senior ministers, from entering Russia over the UK's hostile stance on the war in Ukraine. The BBC's Helena Wilkinson has the report.
This was once one of Russia's most prized warships. Now the Moskva lies at the bottom of the Black Sea. It's a huge blow to the country and its naval power. Ukraine claimed it hit the cruiser with two missiles. Russia denied this, saying an explosion on board caused it to sink. The country held a ceremony to mourn its loss. For Ukrainians, the sinking of the warship is a morale boost. Many have queued to buy this stamp, showing a Ukrainian border guard defiantly standing up to the vessel. But there have already been repercussions. Russia says it hit a military facility outside the Ukrainian capital, an attack seen as retaliation. It threatened more strikes on Kyiv if Ukraine attacks Russian territory. The Kremlin has also issued a warning to the United States and its allies, saying supplying further arms to Ukraine would add fuel to the conflict and could lead to unpredictable consequences. But President Zelensky has issued another call for world leaders to back the Ukrainian effort with weapons.
If someone says a year or years, I answer, you can make the war much shorter. The more weapons we get, and the sooner we get all the weapons we have requested, the stronger our position will be, and the sooner peace will come.
He's also warned the world should be ready for a possible Russian nuclear or chemical attack. Speaking on CNN, he said Russia could do it because people's lives meant nothing to Moscow. As the fighting continues, so too does the grim task of recovering those who've been killed in the war. Ukrainian police say they found the bodies of 900 civilians in the region around Kyiv. The capital remains a target, and there are fears there could be fresh attacks in and around it in the coming days. Helena Wilkinson, BBC News.
Well, our correspondent Dan Johnson is in Lviv, and he gave me more detail about those overnight strikes.
Yeah, explosions reported in one of the suburbs on the edge of Kyiv. The mayor of the city says that emergency teams are responding to that blast. We don't have any confirmation yet of exactly how much damage has been done, whether there are any injuries or loss of life there. There was also an air raid attack on Lviv last night on this city. We're told by local officials that two Russian jets launched an attack having flown from Belarus. Apparently four missiles were fired at targets in Lviv, but they were shot down by Ukrainian air defences. It's a reminder to people here that even though they're hundreds of miles from the really intense fighting in the east of Ukraine, there are still risks, and Russia had threatened renewed attacks. It said in response to Ukrainian helicopters firing on villages over the border in Russia itself, the suspicion is that Russia is responding to show that its firepower isn't diminished despite the flagship of the Black Sea Fleet having sunk to the bottom of the ocean. We also have that warning from Vladimir Putin, which was messaged to the Americans earlier this week, that if they continue to supply weapons to Ukraine, there could be unintended consequences. President Vladimir Zelensky has talked about the potential for Russia to launch chemical weapons attacks and potentially nuclear attacks as well. But it was after that message was sent to the Americans that they announced further supplies would be sent to reinforce the Ukrainian resistance in expectation of those even greater battles to come in the east of the country. But right across Ukraine, renewed strikes, further air raid warnings, and nervousness for people in this country.
It doesn't appear that that this is winding down the Ukrainian-Russia war. So we're just going to see a continued buildup of the Ukrainian with new weapons systems and so forth. So don't see anything good about it. The cruiser got too close. And it got distracted, they say, by these drones operated by the Ukrainians. And so it was hit by these Neptune missiles that were manufactured, they say, in Kyiv. But now they're saying the Russians took that plant out within hours after the sinking of the Moscow cruiser, 611 feet, well over, a little over 500 men. They think that they've lost well between 470 up to 500 men that drowned, went down with the ship, but they don't know for sure the number. They're saying right now there are 50 survivors, but the Russians are releasing scant information about what really happened. So, I mean, this war is hell, and it, I mean, and there were cars left in Sevastopol in the parking lot where the sailors that sailed on that ship usually parked their cars. So that's how they're estimating the number of losses of that Moscow cruiser. Well, thank you for listening, and God bless each and every one of you. Bye-bye. Good night.